This is the Hoboken Grace Podcast. Whether you're in the car or enjoying a walk, we hope you're having a great day. Just like every weekly conversation, we hope today's message deepens your relationship with God and builds into your life in a helpful way. For access to our full podcast library, visit hobokengrace.com or our app.
And we have been able to celebrate with so many who have taken that step over the last month. And I want to let you know, if you're here and you've been thinking about taking that step, you're not sure, after each of our services today, we have something called What is Baptism? It just answers those questions for you. It's going to be downstairs right after the service in the glass room. The next room is what we call it, and the entryway there. And they would love to be able to walk you through that. If I haven't had a chance to meet you, my name is Chris. I'm the lead pastor here at Hoboken Grace. And right now we are in the midst of this conversation called The Real Jesus. And we are looking at John's account. John is Jesus's best friend. He's the closest disciple to Jesus. We're looking at his account of Jesus's life and asking, okay, does my idea of Jesus, or what I've heard about Jesus, or maybe I've read a little bit over here, and I've kind of put together this picture of Jesus, does that actually match with who he is? And for many of us, we're kind of trying to shape that picture because we've never actually taken the time to be able to read through the entire account of his life. And so I challenge you to be reading through the book of John with us in your personal life. And then on Sundays, we're just moving through this a chapter at a time. And today we're going to jump into chapter 4. Before we do that, I want to jump really quickly back to chapter 2. I know some of you are like, don't go backwards, Chris. Don't go backwards. But really quickly, let me just share this with you because I think you need to understand what John's doing here. So at the end of chapter 2, he said this. He said, but Jesus would not entrust himself to them. He's talking about how he was beginning to grow in popularity and there was a crowd. He said, but Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all men. He did not need man's testimony about man, for he knew what was in man. And so John, again, continuing to establish that Jesus is God, says, listen, Jesus didn't just know people from the outside. He didn't just see people in terms of what was visible. He knew what was happening at the core of people. He knew what was happening in their heart at a soul level. And then what he does from there, as you move through chapter 3 and chapter 4, is he gives you examples of that. So Nicodemus last week was an example of that. And Jesus didn't just see what was on the outside as it pertained to Nicodemus. He saw this teacher, this Pharisee who was hiding. He knew what was happening on the inside. And John is giving you examples. And he gives us three different examples, actually. The one we're going to talk about today, Nicodemus last week. And then next, as you continue through chapter 4, we're not actually going to look at this story. You see this royal official who Jesus heals his son, and that's the third example. And in all three situations, very different people, you see Jesus seeing beyond the surface. And he sees what's happening in their life at a soul level, and he calls that out. Today, I want to take you to the second example of that, and we're going to look at the beginning of chapter 4. It starts off and it says this. Now, he had to go through Samaria. It says he had to go. He didn't actually have to go. You can go around Samaria, but it seems that he felt he had to. There was something he had to do. I think as you move through the story, you realize there was someone he had to meet. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. And John's referencing something from the Jewish scriptures from the Old Testament. He's talking about when the nation of Israel first moved into this land. And you say, who's Jacob? Jacob is actually Abraham's grandson, and Joseph is his great-grandson. And it's talking about how they distributed the land. And so it's just kind of giving you where they were. It says, Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. And so he comes to this well, he sits down. It was about the sixth hour. Now, that doesn't mean it was 6 a.m., because they typically counted hours from the time that the sun came up. So most people believe it's around noon. So it's around noon, he's sitting at this well. It says, when a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. So he's sitting there. She comes to draw water. He says, "Hey, listen, can I get a drink?" The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." So he asked her for a drink. She says, "Wait a second, you're a Jew, I'm a Samaritan. Why are you asking me for a drink?" And there's kind of a little bit of sarcasm in her response, but because it's kind of, "Hey, listen, you don't associate with me, and you Jews, you don't associate with us usually, so now you're going to associate with us when you need something from me?" And she kind of has this tone of, "Oh, now it's okay for you to talk to me." And there was this huge divide between the Samaritans and the Jews, because the Samaritans and the Jews disagreed on, okay, how you pursue God and where you worship God. And there's all this back and forth between the two of them, and the Jews really looked down on the Samaritans. And so she looks at him and says, "Oh, you guys are cool with looking down on us all the time and not associating with us, but now that you need something, you're going to ask me for something." Jesus picks up on the sarcasm, because listen to how he responds. He says, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." She says, "Oh, now you're going to ask me when you need something?" And he says, "Actually, if you knew who I was, I wouldn't be the one asking. You'd be the one asking. You'd be asking me for something." And then he uses this phrase. This is really important. "You'd be asking me for living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep." She looks at him and says, "Do you know how wells work? Because I don't think you have anything to get any water." It's kind of an interesting back and forth between the two of them. "Where can you get this living water?" And remember, Jesus said, "If you knew who I am." So she says this, "Are you greater than our father Jacob?" Well, you think you're someone special? Like, you think, are you more significant than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and flocks and herds? I don't know who you think you are, but I don't really care. Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst." He says, "This water you have to come back over and over and over again. It doesn't actually quench your thirst. But whoever drinks the water I give will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." And he does the same thing with her that he does with Nicodemus, because with Nicodemus, he's talking about you have to be born again. Nicodemus gets caught up on the physical. Jesus says, "We're not actually talking about the physical. We're talking about the spiritual. I'm just using this to capture what I'm trying to help you understand." And so he says, this water that I'm talking about, it has to do with eternal life. At this point, I think the woman's pretty convinced he's crazy. But she's like, "Hey, let's go for it." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." She says, Sure. "If you can do that, give it to me. Then I don't have to come back to the well. I'll take it. If you can do it, crazy man, I'll take it." And then things get weird really quickly, because they're having this conversation, kind of this back and forth between the two of them, talking about water. And then Jesus says this. He told her, "Go call your husband and come back." What? Where'd that come from? We're talking about water. Where does the husband thing come from? What are you talking about? She doesn't argue with him. She just says, "I have no husband," she replied. And then Jesus says this. Jesus said to her, "You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you've had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you've said is quite true." Wow. Wow. Like, you thought it went left a little bit ago. Now, what? Now I told you, it gets real weird. Like, wait a second. Where did that come from? And ow, like that. That's intense. That's really intense. And I don't know about you, but that seems kind of mean, doesn't it? I feel like there's other ways to say that. Couldn't you just have gone into it and said, hey, let's talk about your relationships. How are they going? That may have been a kinder way to come into it. Nope. I mean, he goes right to it. And for a long time, I really struggled with this passage. I really struggled with this passage because I couldn't figure out what he's doing. And honestly, it seems mean. Like, that's harsh. And I didn't really know what to do with it, but I had to be honest about it. And this is really important because as we're moving through this, you have to be honest about it. You can't just move past the passage and not look at what really happened, which is what we usually do. We come to a moment in Jesus' life that doesn't fit our picture. And so we either try to explain it away or we just move past it. It doesn't shape our picture. It doesn't shape our understanding. And we try, what we do is we cram the story of Jesus into the box we created. Instead of actually coming and saying, who was he? Because, let's just do this for a second. Practice this with me. Take everything you know about Jesus and set it aside. Let's just for a second say to ourselves, everything I've been told up until this point is a lie. I'm going to set that aside. Now, come to the book of John and read the first four chapters. At this point, is Jesus nice? Nervous laughter. Is he nice? I mean, we've seen him go to the temple and throw things. And we kind of understand why he did it, but then with Nicodemus, he seems kind, like he's pretty intense with Nicodemus too. But he says, I'm here not to condemn, but to save the world. And that sounds nice. But then you come to this moment, you're like, whoa. I mean, if you're honest about this moment and you're honest about the first four chapters, at this point, you're thinking, I hope I don't run into that guy. I'm not sure I'd want to run into him. Because that's intense. And I struggled with it because I didn't want to just move past it and I didn't want to ignore it. And listen, Jesus, I don't get to tell him who he is. And if I'm going to understand him and I'm going to understand what he came to do, then I have to. Well, he has to tell me who he is. For so many of us, we think God needs to answer to us. Listen, God, you have to live up to who I think you should be. And you have to fit in my box. It's interesting to me how many people literally say to me, listen, If that's true, then I don't believe in God. If God doesn't fit in your box, then you're just not going to believe in God? That's a weird thing to say. God not fitting into your box doesn't mean he's not God. And so I looked at it and I said, well, what in the world is he doing? And let's bring back in the rest of what we've been told about Jesus. So the other reason why it really confused me, this passage in particular, is that there's a pattern that you'll notice with Jesus. When Jesus encounters people who are proud, he's usually very intense and very almost harsh. I mean, there is a point where he looks at the Pharisees and says, you're going to hell and you're taking everyone with you. That's not gentle. That's intense. And when he encounters people who are proud, you see that pretty consistently. Now, when he encounters people who are broken and are in shame, he's usually very gentle. Make no mistake about it, he is encountering someone who is broken and in shame. That's why she's at the well at noon. She doesn't want to run into anybody she knows, because everybody knows what Jesus just called out. And so just like Nicodemus was hiding, she's hiding, but in a little bit different way, which threw me off, because why this shift? It just seems, Jesus, like you're doing something different. It doesn't fit with the way I usually see you act. And I struggled with it for a long time until I came to Jeremiah 2. And I don't remember if I was reading it or if I heard someone teaching it, but there's a line in Jeremiah 2 that stood out to me. Let me take you this moment. God's talking about the nation of Israel. And as he's talking about the nation of Israel, he says this. He says, "My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water." Now, when I heard that phrase, I immediately came back to that conversation with Jesus. It's like, wait. Jesus, in this moment, as he sits beside this well, is quoting from Jeremiah 2. He's capturing this idea, the spring, because he doesn't just talk about living water. He talks about a spring that wells up within you. And God says, "They've forsaken me, the spring of living water." And then he says, number two, "and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water." He says, not only have they abandoned me, the spring of living water, but the second thing they've done is they've dug broken cisterns. Now, cisterns were very common in the ancient world because it's how they collected water. They needed to be able to hold water for all sorts of different reasons. And even though they typically used wells and springs to be able to drink from, cisterns where they needed water to clean things. And so what they would do is they dig these holes. A cistern is not really all that beautiful. Now, if you go to Rome, you can find like really beautiful ones, but most of them look something like this. It's just a hole. And you dig it, you collect rainwater, and you could go and draw from it, and you could build those things closer to your house than the well, so you didn't have to go quite as far. Now, a cistern was only valuable if it held water. Do you know what a cracked cistern doesn't do? Hold water. Now, it will hold water for a little bit, but eventually it will run dry. And if you know anything about leaks, which if you live in Hoboken, you probably do. I don't know why we struggle with water so much, but leaks don't get smaller, do they? They get bigger. And so not only will it run dry, but it will run dry faster and faster and faster and faster. And God says to the nation of Israel, he says, "I'm actually the source of living water. But rather than you coming to me for it and experiencing that spring of water, you've dug these cracked cisterns. You've turned to something else to try to find life. And it's left you dry." And when I saw that passage, all of a sudden I realized, oh my goodness, that's what Jesus was doing. He's addressing Jeremiah 2 in her life. And he says, "I've come for you to have living water that results in eternal life, to have the spring welling up inside of you that quenches your thirst, where you don't have to keep coming back to the well over and over and over again." And she says, "If you can do that, I'd like to have it." And he says, "Okay, let's talk about your cracked cistern." Let's talk about where you've been trying to find satisfaction and it's left you empty. The reason he calls it out isn't because he's trying to be harsh. or because he's trying to be mean. It's because he wants her to see where she's been trying, where she's thought, I can find life here, I can find satisfaction here, and it has left her empty. And so he says, I know. You've been living life believing that if you just found the right person, you'd finally be satisfied. You'd finally find life. I know what you've been chasing, and I know it's left you empty. And he's calling her exactly the way God's calling the nation of Israel in Jeremiah 2, to change direction, to realize, I've been looking for it in the wrong place. I've been looking for it in the wrong place. All of us do this. All of us do this. Let me ask you, what's your cracked cistern? Man, if I can just get that promotion. How many promotions can you say that about? You got the one, and that didn't satisfy. And then you got the next one. I mean, you could say the same thing about you that he said about her. Actually, well, you've had 5 promotions and you're still dreaming about the other one. If I can just save that much. Maybe for you it's vacations. If I could just travel to that place, I'd find life. I'd find sex. For so many of us, it's relationships. If I can just find the right person. Maybe for you, it's family. If I could just have that family. This is fun to watch. Turn your kids into the place where you find life. Turn them into a cistern. See how long that holds water. What is it for you? What is it that you think would actually satisfy? Or maybe for you, you've given up on finding the satisfaction, and so you're just covering up the fact that you're dry and empty. And so the drugs just allows you to ignore the fact that it doesn't matter. Nothing satisfies. What is it? I love this about Jesus. I love this about Jesus. You see it with Nicodemus, you see it again. Jesus meets her where she is. He had to go through Samaria. He doesn't show up at the well early when everyone else is going to be there. He shows up when only she'll be there. Because he wants to meet her where she is. But he's not interested in letting her stay there. Jesus will meet you where you are, but he is not interested in letting you stay there. And if you've come into this, if you're on this journey and you think, oh, love is just letting people stay where they are. Love is just allowing them to figure out what's true for them. And that's, You can believe that. Jesus didn't. He didn't believe that about Nicodemus. He doesn't believe that about her. No, he steps in and says, no, there's a way to life. And I can lead you there. I'm going to meet you where you're at, but we're not staying here. Because I'm not interested. And this is true for every one of you. As Jesus steps into your life, you need to know this about him. He is not interested in you settling for an empty life. Not interested. He won't do it. What is it for you? Now, I love the way that she responds. I love the way that she responds. Because, I mean, imagine you being in that situation. How would you respond? Like, do you just leave? Like, do you slap him? Like, how does this thing play out? Like, this is kind of a crazy, intense moment. It got really real, really fast. And this is what she says. Listen to what she said. Sir, the woman said, I can see that you're a prophet. I see you know some things. Okay. And then she says, our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. What? And you see the same thing. Jesus makes this hard left, and then after he says this to her, she makes this hard right. He's like, let's talk about your personal life. She's like, let's talk about theology. That's literally what she does. Let's talk about what's happening inside of you. No, let's talk about where we should worship. And I love this. I love this because I've experienced this so many times with people. We're all being in a conversation with people and all of a sudden God gets really close, and randomly they'll throw out some question about Noah and the ark. I'll be like, we're right there. I can see Jesus is working in them. And they realize, man, this is really real and this is really personal. And they're like, but how many days were they on the ark? And what about the dinosaurs? And I'm like, what does this have anything to do with anything? But they'll throw out some random theology question. I've experienced it so many times. And so I was so encouraged when I saw, oh my goodness, people did this to Jesus too. And some of you have done that. Some of you are here and your friend invited you and you're exploring this thing. But whenever God gets close, you know what you do? You turn to the random theology question because, and this is really important, the easiest place, or often the easiest place, to hide from God is religion. And if you can keep Jesus a religion, it doesn't have to become personal. And so some of you, it's why you don't like our church. You're like, no, they see Jesus as personal. I don't want that. I like the religion thing. Religion keeps Jesus at an arm's length. I can go through the motions and I can do the things and all that, but let's not get personal. Jesus steps into her life and says, we're going to get personal. And she says, no. I'm good. And she asks this random theology question. Jesus answers her. He says, believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. And then in the next few lines, he basically says to her, the answer to the question doesn't really matter. Let's get back to what we were talking about. He says the answer to the question doesn't matter because there's not going to be a temple anymore. You're going to worship in spirit. I'm changing the whole deal. So it's not even worth us talking about it any further. And then she does another thing that I see people do when it gets really intense and really personal. The woman said, I know that Messiah called Christ is coming. When he comes, he'll explain everything to us. And so he says, the answer to your question doesn't really matter. And she says, okay, well, I mean, let's be honest. Who can know? Who can know? I experienced people doing this to me too. They're like, well, I mean, yeah, who can know though? You can never know. No one can know. So we're good. Jesus responds. Then Jesus declared, I who speak to you am he. He looks at her and he says, now, I'm here so you can know. Remember what John has said from the beginning that Jesus came to do? For you to know the Father. And Jesus in this moment is saying to her, the time of who can know is done. Now you can know. Now you can know. And not only can you know, you can be known, and you don't have to be afraid of it. You can know. And I'm here for you to know. Because when you know the Father, and when you know me, all of a sudden, that thirst that you have for love, that thirst that you have for value, that thirst that you have for belonging can be satisfied. You don't have to chase it anymore. You don't have to chase it anymore. And she realizes that she's encountered the Messiah. And so listen to what it says. Then, leaving her water jar, I love that detail. All of a sudden, the physical didn't matter anymore, does it? The woman went back into the town and said to the people, come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Now, notice this transformation. At the beginning of the story, what is she doing? She's hiding and she's in shame. She's doing everything that she can to avoid. She's doing everything that she can to make sure that she doesn't encounter those people. Then she meets Jesus, and all of a sudden her shame turns to salvation. And she runs into town. And she's not hiding what the reality of her situation anymore. She says, he told me everything I ever did. You know it, I know it, and he told me it. It's crazy. But she's not ashamed of it anymore. Why? It's exactly what Jesus said to Nicodemus. If you step into the light, you won't find condemnation. You'll find salvation. Now, she didn't step into the light voluntarily. Jesus drug her into it. Let's be honest. But she realized, wait a second. This is the Messiah, and he knows me, and he still pursued me. He knew it, and he didn't run from me. And he didn't tell me I couldn't find it. He told me he was here for me to find it. What are you chasing? What are you chasing? My people have committed two sins, he says. They've forsaken me, the spring of living water. And they've built for themselves cisterns, cracked cisterns. God's calling them back. But if you're going to come back, you have to identify. Where is it that I've believed the lie? What is it that I've thought I can find life here? You have to identify it. And then, you have to decide, I'm not pursuing that anymore. And all the energy I've been putting into pursuing that, I'm going to direct toward him. All that energy you've been putting into, I'm going to get my career and I'm going to get ahead. All that energy you've been putting into, I got to save enough. All that energy you've been putting into all these relationships that have left you empty. Just say, no, I'm done with that. No more crack cisterns. He's where life is found. That time with him that we've been talking about through this whole series. Why is that important? Well, he's what satisfies. Nothing else. He's what satisfies. I don't know where you are today. I don't know if you need to, for the very first time, say, man, God, I have been trying to find life in all these other places. And for the first time, you need to say, I want for you to be what satisfies. I don't want just the religion thing anymore. I want it to be personal. I want to be yours. Or maybe for you, you've experienced the living water, but you've forsaken it. Then you've turned to something else. And you need to go to him today and say, listen, I'm sorry. I know you're the source. And I still traded you for something else. And it's time for you to come home. It's time for you to come home. I don't know where you are, but as I pray, I want to invite you to have that conversation with him. Will you pray with me? Father, I thank you so much for this reality that we don't have to spend our life chasing. This reality, Jesus, that you came so that we could know. You came so that it would become personal. You came so that your love, the way you value us, the way you pursue us, that would become in us a spring, satisfying the cravings of our soul. Father, we turn to you. We turn to you. In awe and wonder, and we say, we are yours. Yours. In Jesus' name.